Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 596.EX2208, certificate number 23421. Honest Dick.
Don't you hope that whoever the listeners of the future are, that they are ruled by good and just and wise men or giant spider crabs or warrior queens or whoever? Like, unless they're a true hive collective, they will have some kind of leadership. Even a hive has a queen.
Well, it's true, although does an aspen have a queen?
Yeah. Yeah, the queen aspen.
Uh-huh.
She's the only one that can reproduce. The other aspens bring her different kinds of jellies and lichens.
I learned yesterday that an ant queen, just a regular ant queen, can live for 30 years.
30 years?
Yeah. The other ants come and groom her and take away her bad skin or something, and she just continues to grow. And
do you think they know, like, I lived longer than Jimi Hendrix? Like, do you think those ants are, like, aware of how cool that is?
That's what I'm wondering. Like, I used to kind of deal with ants somewhat with impunity, and now I feel like they are wise.
Can you check to see if the one you're about to kill is...
I think the worker ants even live for 2 years. They've been in the shit, man. They've seen some stuff. The ants, like, you know, they live longer than tulips. I celebrate tulips.
Maybe their time perception is related to their, like, maybe no matter how long you live, it feels the same. Like, so to them, time is passing incredibly slowly. You know, they watch a perfect bead of rain fall extremely slowly.
And it seems like a glacier to them.
Form a little crown as it gloops up off the sidewalk because they're getting the same amount of experience we are.
How do they feel when they get washed down the bathtub drain by my shower head?
It's agonizing torture. Like, we're just like, oh, this will be no problem. Psh, 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 psh. And to them, it's like they're being waterboarded for a year.
As someone who has studied government, I feel like the prospect that futurelings will have a kind of benevolent oligarchy or, you know, like altruistic philosopher king.
Just some utopia.
Seems unlikely, given how...
I thought you were going to say it was a near guarantee.
No, I would have always said that. You know, as a liberal, I am intrinsically a utopian, right? Liberals think that things are going to keep getting
better. We're all very chipper about government, despite all available evidence.
Well, no, but I mean, you think that it is possible to get better, because that's what all our policies are about, right? If we just do this and then do that, then...
If we didn't believe that, we would just take our ball and go home.
Right.
And we'd be conservatives, basically.
Right.
Shut down the government for a month. It's fine.
Conservatives assume that things are going to be rough and their policies are to secure...
Yeah, it's damage control.
Right.
I want me and mine to be safe because everybody else is out to get me and things are just getting gloomier.
Yeah, people are intrinsically untrustworthy. But, you know, the left keeps thinking, oh, if we give 10% more to the schools, people will be educated, and then they'll choose a leftist government.
Even though all the tweaks we've made to this policy have not worked yet, there is somewhere the perfect tweak.
Right.
If we could just find that lost chord, that perfect tweak.
The perfect tweak.
And just think how, what an amazing social safety net we'd have, where all would have everything they needed. What a dream it would be.
One more socialist in the state house. And the whole house of cards will tip.
There's a tipping point. We just haven't quite got it.
And so, having looked at government and its many incarnations over the last 2,000 years.
You're older than you look.
I do not. Well, they call me the queen ant.
He's an ant queen.
I am less and less inclined to think that there's one more tweak. I don't know if this is confirming your bias that as I get older, I become more conservative, but I less and less think that one more curriculum change at the community college level is going to produce a generation of wise voters.
Did this change during your brush with politics? Did you go into that thing, a cheery-eyed young Democrat type and came out of it a sad-eyed and realistic, sadder but wiser man?
After all the time I was growing up adjacent to politics, what I learned is that politics is an avocation, or the idea that a lot of us have that what we need is new blood. We need to.
The problem is that the politicians are not like me. That's kind of the essential ego at the core of it.
Right.
If every politician was like me, clearly things would be good because I'm good.
And so what we need to do is elect outsiders. Well, the problem is, no, outsiders are bad for politics. The people in politics have made a lifetime of learning the ins and outs. And of course there's corruption, of course there, but more than corruption, there's just an insider language. It's just, we don't say like, these bridges are ugly. We need some outsiders in there designing bridges.
We need a barista to design this bridge.
Like people that decide to be engineers, bridge engineers, we're stuck with them. Right? Because that's who decided to become engineers, and they're the ones that design bridges. If you don't like the bridges, I mean, your option is to raise your child and send them to engineering school.
Or buy a dinghy,
right. So politics is exactly like that.
Didn't you have a story when you were running about, some Seattle city councilor actually telling you, you look like somebody who's just going to make up your mind on each issue. And we do not want that. That's the last thing I want. I want someone whose vote I can always predict, because otherwise, how do I do my job?
So all the people in politics talk about each other all the time and they gossip about each other, but they know where one another stand because they've all been in politics since they were in college, right? They volunteer on other people's campaigns. They're active in the local party apparatus. This is what they want to do, and this is what they've been doing.
And think how hard it would be to make decisions if suddenly that was stripped away.
So he came to me, and in all confidence, he was like, we've been talking about you, everybody in the local Democrats, and we like you. You're a nice guy. You've got the political acumen, but you seem to think that you just are going to vote on things based on the available information and your own instinct.
Weirdo.
And that's really not what we're looking for. Because going into any kind of vote,
he's got to do the math. Yeah.
And like, where do we direct our lobbying attention, right? We need to know that four people are definitely in favor of it. Like it oscillates constantly. And a lot of times you push legislation down the road and then the other party gets in and pushes it back. We've been living in a period where one of the parties is just intransigent, and now we have some young people but they're just pursuing a Democratic agenda. It's not like anybody has arrived on the scene with some radical notion.
Like their radical notion is that the tax bracket should be what they were under Nixon.
Yeah, exactly.
What if
we, FDR is still the most liberal president in American history. I mean, some of the things that FDR proposed would make a American socialist blanch at their audacity. I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer, and certainly I would never look askance at the new generation of people in the left, but you also have to temper it with a little historical knowledge and say, like, yeah, pendulum, it's a pendulum.
The pendulum's complicated today by the fact that you know, a certain segment of one party is kind of openly kleptocratic in a way we have not seen in the past.
Well, they're openly kleptocratic, whereas in the past it was just an agreed upon.
And I assume that was true, right? There were always these kind of bounds of good behavior with which we were okay with our leaders fattening themselves and their pet causes and constituencies.
Yeah, well, pork barrel politics is the term.
Right.
And it was a major criticism of the Democrats for most of the 20th century that they were fattening up their coffers and the unions and all their developer friends.
And nobody would mind when Reagan would do a speaking tour or Obama got a fat book deal. We kind of nodded and said, yeah, this is the well-behaved way to get rich on a career in public service.
Although that's not graft at the expense of the public to go on a speaking tour.
It is not. But if your idea is that your leaders, civil servants, are somehow not in this for themselves in any way, but they're there for the good of the state. That's not something we require in any other job, by the way. Can you imagine? Like, I think I'm going to take this low-paying job because what the accounting industry needs is for me to be working here. I mean, no one else ever thinks that way, but we kind of assume our leaders will.
I mean, and when I was running for office here, a big question is how you raise your money, where your money comes from. And there's on the left especially, this sense that if you take money from anyone other than mom and pop little guy, if anybody gives you money, it's in the public record, and your opponent is going to go in there and say, the guy that owns the McChicken sandwich place gave you $200. You're in service to Big Chicken. And, you know.
But I'm convinced by that in certain cases, you know, when you see how intransigent, for example, even the Democratic Party has been on issues that you'd think would be a no-brainer for the left, you know, to go against things that everybody hates, you know, about the finance industry or about, you know, executive salaries or about the whole health insurance layer of our healthcare system that makes no sense. And yet, these people who have all got nice fat checks from these industries are saying, no, we don't want to, you don't want to get rid of health and, you know, the health insurance industry, that thing everyone loves. I mean, maybe we'll provide some kind of public option alternative, but...
And sadly, a lot of that is the public face of what's effectively horse trading behind the scenes, where people come and say, look, if you really were sincere about reforming the health insurance industry, the repercussions are going to be this, 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 and this, and pretty soon all of capitalism is in flames. And so you have to, we'll agree to this, but we want this in return. And then pretty soon the guy that's standing over here has got something to say about it because that affects him. And it becomes a rat king of competing interests.
So incrementalism is just built into the complexity of it?
Because there's always somebody on the other side of wherever you draw the aisle that also has a constituency and money and authority.
But you don't get the sense that things that are just ridiculously popular are not even being tried?
Well, I mean, for instance—
Because the money that stacks up on the other side doesn't, you know, makes the no-brainerness seem like less of a no-brainer?
We talked about this in an early episode of The Omnibus, the water rights of the West, where it's a no-brainer that the U.S. government should not be providing free water to giant farmers who are
in a desert,
farming strawberries in a desert, while municipalities don't have drinking water. But because of the land use plans that were put in place a long, long time ago by people with certain interests, the simple act of removing that free water would create this cascade of broken promises that would sort of wreck the West, and none of the people in between you and the person in Los Angeles who just wants clean drinking water are going to agree to it because they all have, it's not just a finger in the pie.
That just sounds like your guy wanting a predictable vote on the city council.
It is.
Like this seems like it would be very, make my job more difficult and make a lot of people's jobs more difficult. So instead of figuring it out, it stays the bad way.
And the thing is, that's what's so appealing about the idea of an authority, a king. Every person that you talk to about politics wants to be the king for a day, right? Because if you could come in and just say, by fiat, I am changing this. I'm starting again.
I'm Hugo Chavez, and I'm nationalizing strawberry water.
Right. the temptation is to think that that's what we need. Just somebody with the, and in America, we want somebody with the charisma to do it because we don't want to give somebody the power. So we want someone with the charisma to convince
exactly,
everyone.
Exactly. The twinkle in the eye.
Because we don't want to cede all the authority. But I mean, if you look through history, you got your Hugo Chavez is a great example, but there are 100,000 examples.
Yeah, this is all stuff that tends to make kleptocracy worse. When you look at the list of people who have personally fattened themselves most on the public coffers, they're terrible dictators. And the numbers are pretty astounding. Suharto in Indonesia, somewhere maybe as much as $30 billion.
He stole from them.
Yeah. Marcos, the numbers are in the billions with a B. Marcos, you know, as much as 20 billion. Mobutu Sese Seko and Zaire, 5 billion. Vladimir Putin, I mean, depending on how you do the math, it could be as high as $200 billion.
And that's one thing in America. We have a lot of checks and balances that keep national politicians, at least, from profiting from the public. Although Trump, I think, is really testing.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of those checks and balances tended to be just mores of good behavior
right,
that we were all nodding sagely about.
Gentlemen's agreements.
And it turns out nothing happens if you grant different diplomatic rights to whoever buys the most rooms in your hotel. There doesn't appear to be any law against it that it will be enforced.
I read an article the other day that the military and intelligence briefers were talking to him about Diego Garcia, where we have an island where we have a military base down in the Indian Ocean that's pretty crucial to our whole sense of global order. And they were telling him all about this island and what we needed to have happen there. And his only question was, are the beaches nice? and the director of intelligence was like, I honestly think he was just thinking of it in terms of like hotel development.
I thought he was going to say, Diego Garcia, can't we just deport him? So, you know, the idea of kleptocracy and people choosing to fatten themselves at the public trough brings us to the hero of today's story, finally.
Yeah. This isn't even within the top 100 of the longest.
Are we still less than half an hour in?
Longest times. Apparently, according to my recording gear, we are 6 hours and 15 minutes into this show.
Wow. There's going to be a long, long pregame, which is whatever was happening in this room at like 4 a.m. this morning. Were you stomping through here?
I think I was playing,
swearing at raccoons.
I was playing that drum kit for a while. It could be some jamming tracks on.
So this. The future is probably not listening at this point. Honest Dick was not born Honest Dick. His name was James Tate, and he was a long-serving politician in the state of Kentucky in the years immediately before and then during and after the Civil War, so the middle of the 19th century.
Kentucky, these are my people.
In that you aspire to be one of their colonels?
I have.
Like their ABA team?
A listener from the very, very distant future of Omnibus connected with me through the time portals across the flat circle.
The Taurus of time.
And said that she was going to nominate me to be a Kentucky colonel in the of the future types. When Kentucky is an oceanfront state.
Yeah, it's literally bluegrass. It's like the blue seaweed state.
the living, thinking, mobile bluegrass of Kentucky. And, you know, I have connections to Kentucky, family connections and other connections. And so
having changed flights in Cincinnati does not count as other connections to Kentucky.
No. I have deep roots there. And, but then mysteriously, maybe the time portal closed, but she has not followed up on the ruling of whether or not my Kentucky colonelship is in
the mail. Maybe she was just waiting for a nice check to arrive from you. She's like,
oh, it was some graft.
It was some Kentucky graft.
I didn't get her signal.
James Tate was a long-serving assistant secretary of state for the state of Kentucky. And then for many years, he was like an assistant clerk to the state legislature.
This is pre-Civil War.
The House of Representatives. Yeah, starting in the 1850s. But in 1868, he was elected the treasurer of the state of Kentucky for the first time.
So he was one of these people from the Middle West in the mid-19th century who had no real formal education, right? He went to school in Kentucky and then became a...
Sure, this was a time when even national politics could be run by people who had just waved their saber at the right time during the Civil War, and suddenly you're your party's nominee for vice president, and you never went to law school.
Yeah, he had
never graduated from high school.
Seventh grade education, but now was pretty high ranking in the Kentucky Democrats.
Yes, after the Civil War, the Democratic Party essentially controlled Kentucky politics. The Republicans were unable to make much of an inroads. After Reconstruction, popular with black voters, maybe, but that's about it. So he was able to win 10 consecutive terms as the Kentucky state treasurer.
Really? I didn't realize that was a...
Every 2 years, I guess they...
Oh, right. It was a two-year election.
Every state has a treasurer. It's just the person in charge of the state's fiscal resources and responsibility. You know, not just the money on hand, but where it gets invested, who has to get paid when. Somebody has to be, you know, just like the treasurer of your debate club in high school, somebody's got to keep an eye on the books.
Right.
And that is James Tate. And he is just beloved. The reason he stays in office for, you know, almost 20 years is because everyone loves him. He's the nicest guy. He's popular, generous, affable, kind, you know, looks out for everybody, always willing to do a good turn, accommodating to whatever kind of favors get asked of him. He's called Honest Dick because it's believed he's above reproach.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like he's exactly the kind of charismatic political figure that people put trust in because of charisma.
It really is the who would you have a beer with?
Right.
And honestly, maybe you can do less harm that way, voting for president that way, than you can voting for a state treasurer. Because maybe a good old boy is what the nation needs sometimes in the White House, but...
My tax accountant never went to college, but boy, what a mensch.
It's not clear where the dick part comes from. I mean...
He's not named Richard.
No, he's James Tate, like the poet. But it almost makes me wonder if this is he's one of these guys that came up with his own nickname.
Oh.
Did you ever have somebody, a friend, who tried to get his own nickname going?
A lot of kids did. My dad at one point said, you know, they used to call me Spider. And I said, that's not true. And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, no, I've never heard anyone call you Spider. And it's an unlikely nickname.
Is he a basketball player?
He was.
What's, you know, did it come from there?
He claimed it did.
Long arms. He's always blocking shots.
But I don't think a single person ever said, hey, Spider. I mean, maybe.
He wanted that so much.
Yeah, he did. Oh, it would be a great nickname. Spider.
Spider.
Although it's not really a great nickname.
Must stop. Spider.
Did you have nicknames?
I never tried to get a nickname
going
for
myself. But did people try to
myself?
Put one on you? What were the nicknames then?
I can't think of a nickname. Ken is a nickname. I was called Kenneth for my entire youth, basically, because my dad was already Ken. So just for ease of
Kenneth.
Ease of use.
I may start doing
I was
that.
The last person in America named Kenneth.
I may start calling you
who
Kenneth.
Who was not Chinese American.
Because you are super Kenneth.
Really? What is Kenneth? Kind of sounds like an irritating British man who knows who goes out to watch the trains.
Yeah, or you know, or someone in short pants like knickers who knows a bunch of trivia.
Well, what nickname would you if you could get any nickname to catch on?
No one has ever succeeded in getting a nickname to really attach to me.
I call you J-Rod all the time.
People do say J-Rod. People say Hot Rod.
That sounds like what you would try to get going in high school.
No. My high school nickname was...
Spider Junior.
Some kids, and they were a year older than me. They were seniors when I was a junior. They were like wordplay theater kids. And one,
I love wordplay theater.
I know. One day I came into a history class and this group of boys in the back of the room said, hey, it's Rip Roarin' Rad Dog Radically Rockin' Reefer and Roderick.
You still know it.
Because they memorized it and said it every day for the rest of the year.
Let's go through them one at a time. Which of those are true?
Rip Roarin' Rad Dog Radical Rockin' Righteously Rascalin' Reefer and Roderick.
It's getting longer.
Was. Yeah.
So were you Rip Roaring at the time? Scale of 1 to 10.
I think I would have. I think I hoped to be. I thought that was pretty flattering.
Were you a rad dog?
I was absolutely a rad dog.
What's the next one?
Rascally? And so it got shortened to Rad Dog. And a lot of people in my high school called me Rad Dog, which I thought was a great 80s.
That's a dream come true.
Ski dude nickname. I actually had Rad Dog engraved in my skis.
You didn't get a tattoo, luckily.
No, no, no. But Rad Dog is what it settled on. So Rip Roarin', maybe. Rad Dog. Radical? Yeah, I was radical.
Were you reefering?
I was rockin'. I was rascally. But I wasn't reefering. I didn't smoke pot until after I graduated from high school. So, no, they assumed I was reefering.
Because of your laid-back ski Rad Dog.
That's right.
Tude.
People assumed I was good with girls, too, because I had a...
None of the nicknames refer to that. No. Unless you left out that because it's no longer acceptable in society. Whatever R thing they had you doing to the
whatever
women.
Whatever R.
The women of Anchorage.
No, these guys were theater dudes, so they weren't thinking in those terms. Although I guess theater people probably have sex with each other all the time. That's one of the main advantages of joining the high school theater.
It's the only reason you do something like band, right? Or
you're,
whatever.
You're in a dark room.
Because it's all a debauched Olympic village of of just broken toys.
Big velvet curtains and ropes.
And costume changes on the sly. My son has a friend named Teddy who has been trying to get Theo going, I guess, for years. Because he's outgrown Teddy and no one will do it.
He's Teddy.
Because once you're Teddy, no one's going to Theo you.
He needs to move and start over. I'm no, Theo.
That's what you do.
Hey, nice to meet you. I'm Theo. Well,
if you move, you can do anything you want. That's how I finally went from Kenneth to Ken. I just had to go to college. Problem solved.
Every John in my family, and I have two uncles named John, and John's all the way back. At a certain point, when they became adults, they switched to Jack. They became Jack. And I think when I was little, my people called me John John, and I thought there would be a transition moment when I would switch to Jack, but no one made it happen, and I didn't think to.
Are you still John John to people? Do they think you're the political future?
The real old ones call me John John, but I feel like the day that I went on Twitter, if I had just gotten Jack Roderick instead of John Roderick—
That was your last best chance.
I would be Jack. Everybody would know me as Jack. I could have just made the switch. Or, you know, when I released my first album, if I had just called myself John Jack Roderick, it would have been...
No rock star has ever had something in quotes between their first and last name. I think that's probably a good move not to do that.
If it had been Ripper, like John Ripper Owens.
Yeah, it's like Spinal Tap members have that, basically. No, frontmen do not.
But yeah, I missed my chance. I'll never be Jack now. No one will ever call me Jack.
James Tate is always called Honest Dick in accounts of his story, although that may be in light of what happened after. We prefer the irony, or maybe we just prefer a good Honest Dick.
Honest Dick, yeah. Well, it resonates against Tricky Dick.
Exactly. Richard what if Nixon. We had had Honest Dick?
Aw.
What if we had had Honest Dick? Think how different our lives would have been.
If you had had Honest Dick, your life would be very different. I don't know if mine would be different.
Your high school nickname might have been different. He was a fixture of Kentucky politics, just being in state treasurer longer than anyone. He's Methuselah, basically, the Louisville Courier-Journal in 1886. And by the way, I was just noticing this. We're living in the last time where I can mention these old-timey papers, and they still exist.
There's still a Methuselah Journal?
No, there's still a the Louisville Courier Journal.
Oh, right.
Isn't that still the Louisville paper?
I think so, although it might all be 100% online.
We have just shocked any futureling.
Or is it owned by McClatchy?
Yeah, that means it'll be gone in a week. Yeah, so nowadays you mentioned the New Orleans Times-Picayune story of 1808, and that's a paper that still exists. And very soon, all papers will sound equally old-timey, except for... You know, the Times and the Post.
The Seattle Post-Intelligencer survived until 2008 or whatever.
It's still online with two employees making listicles somewhere. They're living inside the spinning globe.
I miss it.
Cranking out listicles on their MacBooks. In 1886, the Courier-Journal wrote, "There may not be another earthquake in Kentucky for 20 years, but no doubt the next one come when it may will find Dick Tate still holding the office of state treasurer." Oh, Dick Tate.
Oh,
maybe that's why he became...
I can't imagine.
No?
I can't imagine.
You don't think they were wordplay theater?
I think they were, but I don't think that's how you get a nickname.
And in 1887, the paper poked fun at his long term of office, jokingly telling readers that Tate had served under Andrew Jackson during the War of 1812 and had helped win the Battle of New Orleans. He's a great old man and deservedly popular. So he's just everybody's friend. And in fact... The Encyclopedia of Kentucky, which came out at that time, maybe the first edition.
I have the first edition here.
Do you still get the yearly update?
Yeah.
You turned quickly to the colonel's entry and then your face falls.
Another year.
you know, contemporary to the period, the Encyclopedia of Kentucky claimed that the Democrats actually owed him a lot of their dominance in politics. It wasn't just baked in post-Civil War advantage. It really was.
That he was a master.
He was just beloved.
I see.
And he was kind of the face of the party. So his influence is outsized just for a state treasurer. Can you name the state treasurer of Washington State? I can.
Oh, I should be able to.
You just don't even know. The U.S. has a treasurer, right? Isn't their signature still on money? Is that still a thing?
The Secretary of the Treasury.
No, the Secretary of the Treasury and the Treasurer. Their signatures both used to appear on the money. Oh, but I think no more. Oh, no, they're both there. I just pulled out a $5 bill, and the Secretary of the Treasury is 2013, who was Obama's Secretary of the Treasury. But yes. You can read the Treasurer of the United States on the other side, Ross Boomtastic Rios.
Well, it is now...
There's no way his middle name's Boomtastic.
It is now a woman, Jovita... Carranza.
The Treasurer of the United States.
Is the Treasurer of the United States.
I'm trying to read who this is. Ross? Is it really Ross Rios?
April 2017. Jovita Carranza.
It's often a woman. I've noticed when I look at money, the treasurer is often a woman. I don't know if that's tradition or if it's
kind of a
bone that gets thrown because the guy wants the cabinet level position or...
Well, no, you're absolutely correct. We have had a female treasurer... going all the way back to the last male treasurer was under Harry Truman.
Really?
This is absolutely an episode of The Omnibus.
Yeah, we should definitely not do this now.
Harry Truman appointed the first female treasurer of the United States, and it has been a woman ever since.
Once you found out they were doing a better job.
And in fact, an African-American woman was the treasurer under Jimmy Carter.
Well, Rosa, it does not say Boomtastic. It says Guma Tau Tau, which is Latino, apparently.
Yeah, Rios. Her last
Rosa
name is Rios.
So it's apparently been a Latino woman for a couple of years.
Well, so Jovita Carranza.
What a wonderful phrase.
Before that is Rosa Rios. And before that was Ana Cabral, Ana Escobedo Cabral. So, and then before that, Rosario Marin.
There's an important segment of the U.S. government that's just permanently run by Latino women.
Yes.
I love this.
This is, and then Mary Ellen Withrow before that. Oh, and before her.
The last wasp, Mary Ellen. That's a perfect last wasp name.
Well, except, let me look. But before that, Catalina Vasquez Villa Ipando.
Are we thinking Mary Ellen Withrow is going to be an African-American woman?
No, but well, let me see.
She looks like Barbara Bush in this picture, so.
She does a little.
She was Clinton's treasurer.
He like broke the mold by not having a Latina.
There are a lot of I'm sure he had a Latina.
Where's my bell?
There are a lot of industries where women get locked into particular jobs just by tradition, and it's and that's kind of what shows you that's what keeps them out of other jobs, just failure of imagination. Like for many years in Hollywood, every movie was shot and designed and whatever by a man, but it would be edited by a woman. All the great film editors.
I think that's
women.
Still true. A lot of the great editors are women.
Yeah, and clearly the women could do all those jobs, the other jobs as well. So it's just there was one avenue to success that the patriarchy would allow, and they were like, "Fine, I'll be a woman. I'll be a film editor.
Fine. then I'll be a woman.
I was born a film editor. That was my pronoun, and I've decided to also be a woman. Why are we talking about this? Oh, right, because he's the state treasurer for many years.
Right.
He's a great old man and deservedly popular, which is what the newspaper says. And the Encyclopedia of Kentucky says, it would seem that his lease on the office might be regarded as a fixed fact. So nobody can even imagine a version of Kentucky without this beloved good old boy, honest Dick Tate, holding the purse strings. But in the 1887 election, the Democratic Party has its first real scare. Their nominee is Simon Bolivar Buckner, old Bolivar, who apparently was born at the exact right year for his parents to be very into the stories of Simon Bolivar liberating South America. That's something we don't do anymore. Yeah, white kids being named after great Spanish or Latin American leaders, but it was not infrequent in the early days of the
Republic. When your son Hugo Chavez Jennings was born, it may have been the last incident.
Yeah, I probably pulled the trigger too fast on that. I was like, yes, the great hope of socialism is alive in the Western Hemisphere. Little Hugo, I name you after him, but it didn't go well. So Simon Bolivar Buckner is a Civil War hero, but he's running against a real spellbinder, a great orator, William O. Douglas, kind of the rising star of the Kentucky Republican Party.
William O. Douglas, we'll hear from him later.
And, oh, I misspoke. It is not future Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas.
Right.
That was just muscle memory.
He was from Minnesota.
It's William O. Bradley was their young rising star.
Ah, William O. Bradley.
And, you know, so he's running in this overwhelmingly Democratic state. So what do you do if you're the other party? He runs on kind of a good government ticket.
Right.
He's not interested in these divisive issues. He just wants to tell you that these fat cats have been in power too long.
Sure, he's here to clean up Washington.
He's going to drain the swamp. He's going to clean up Frankfort, Kentucky. Drain the swamp of Frankfort. And so that's what his campaign becomes. Why do we need this new Department of Agriculture? And why do we need all these new railroad commissioners and this fancy new penitentiary?
Hear, hear.
You know, all this mismanagement is actually causing a brain drain, he says.
Huzzah!
All these gifted young colonels are draining out of the state and becoming Ohio colonels and Virginia colonels.
Rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb.
And this becomes very hard for Buckner, old Bolivar, to refute, because it's largely true. The Democratic Party has been in power too long, and they're kind of, even within the party, a lot of people are saying, yeah, this guy's not wrong. Buckner's not a great candidate. Buckner knows Bradley's a better speaker and even refuses to debate him. At their only debate, he says, are you the one that says that somebody else has been writing my speeches? And Bradley's like, yeah, everybody's saying that. And he's like, that's a scurrilous claim and I refuse to share the stage, blah, blah, blah. And then he never debates the guy again.
Which is
pretty genius.
Good job.
So old Bolivar narrowly wins the election, but Bradley has cemented in Kentucky's view this idea that something is amiss in Frankfort. And we need to start looking under the rug and seeing what kind of dust has been swept there. Incidentally, this is the exact same. Buckner, the old Bolivar's term as governor, is marked by two terrible furors, one over Honest Dick, as we shall see, but the other is the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Oh, no kidding.
He was governor during when their feud turned bloody over in the, I guess, eastern part of the state.
Yeah. And that made a big enough stir that it moved the political needle.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that's going to be in the omnibus for sure. We have not done the Hatfields and the McCoys. But the legislature agrees to this idea that comes out of the election, which is we need an audit. Let's show that everything's above board. So they tell Honest Dick, hey, we're going to audit the books. And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Let's give me a couple weeks just to get everything in order.
So they're not auditing it because they've found any irregularities. They're just doing it as like a...
It's become a political football.
A spring cleaning.
But there does appear to be some belief, even on the Democratic side, that, we could use some double checking of how government is running. I think the Democratic Party may be divided. Not everybody thinks Buckner is a great governor. Old Bolivar is a great governor. Mm-hmm. Maybe they said Bolivar. Hard to say. There's no way they said Simon Bolivar Buckner.
But did they say Simon Bolivar?
Simon Bolivar?
Simon Bolivar sounds like a Dickens character.
So they agree to postpone the audit. But the legislature keeps insisting. He's like, I'm just going to need a couple more months. Tate keeps making excuses. And nobody minds because he's on a stick.
Right.
Finally, in March 88th, a very persistent legislator forms the audit commission, sends them to Frankfurt. And they get to the Capitol to find that Honest Dick is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And when inquiries are made, a clerk remembers having not seen him for the last week.
I'm listening.
The clerk saw Honest Dick a week before, holding a large roll of bills, stuffing a coin purse in his pocket, and dragging two large tobacco sacks filled with cash and coin.
Hmm.
He said he was going to be going to Louisville on business and left a note. Uh-huh. Saying he'd be back in 2 days.
Seems reasonable.
Now, this seems reasonable to you. And anybody else perhaps would be suspicious in this situation.
But we're talking about Honest Dick here.
But it's Honest Dick. So nobody can complain about this guy who is literally stuffing his pockets with cash and coins as he leaves the treasurer's office.
And this was a time when it was almost exclusively a cash economy in a lot of these places.
Yeah, you said, right? There was no Scrooge McDuck vault, but the state of Kentucky did have a vault.
Right.
And cash would go in and out. Gold and silver would go in and out.
It's not like you just direct deposited your paycheck and immediately started PayPaling all your creditors.
There are investments, and I'm sure there, you know, there's not everything's in.
There were checks.
Yeah, there's checks, there's pension funds and other things to administer that are not just money in a room.
But money in a tobacco sack.
But there's a ton of money in a room, apparently with purses and tobacco sacks at the ready. And when he has not come back from Louisville after the 2 days and people start asking questions, they remember some facts which are a little bit suggestive. For example, He had a large family, which always seemed to enjoy a very nice lifestyle.
Right.
Even his extended relatives, even his son-in-law, who is apparently famous as a scapegrace and a mountebank.
Oh, dear.
You were a scapegrace and a mountebank yourself.
I was in high school.
When you were rip-roaring rad dog.
Radical, rockin', righteously rascal, and reefer and Roderick.
Yeah.
He was
reportedly reefer and Roderick.
He was a mountebank.
That guy was a ne'er-do-well.
But, you know, it could be that they were just frugal and managed their money well.
Sure. When a cop's wife suddenly has a fur coat and he's got a new car, it doesn't mean he's on the take. It doesn't mean he did the Lufthansa job.
No, he's just been saving up.
People remember that he was enormously generous. The thing everybody loved about him was that he'd do anything you wanted, including give you a large loan anytime you wanted money.
See, now that's where he got the name Honest Dick.
That's where, yeah, of course he's honest. He's giving me money. The audit finds that even Governor Leslie, the former governor of the state of Kentucky, got $5,000 from Honest Dick in 1872 and gave him a little IOU chit.
There you go.
Kentucky is apparently full of people who have given these IOU chits to James Honest Dick Tate.
Well, see, now we're seeing how politics works, right? Because none of those people are going to come out against.
Yeah, it's
Honest
weird.
Dick.
Now the governor was never like, where's he getting this $5,000? I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
And then we start to see people whispering dirty words like peculation and defalcation.
Oh, dear. These are dirty words.
Popular 19. Have you ever committed peculation or defalcation with a minor?
No, I've seen it done.
Those are 19th century terms for embezzlement, which are delightful to me. Peculation and defalcation. And when the audit commission actually takes a look at the books, they find that the treasurer's office is in shambles.
Oh, dear.
There's essentially no demarcation in the defalcation between Honest Dick's private finances and the state of Kentucky. He appears to have treated it all as one large pool. Like the vault of the state has his family effects in it.
Whoa.
One of the assets in the vault is a little coin purse filled with gold and silver that it's clear belongs to a deceased child from the Tate family. And it's just sitting in the vault.
So I don't have a sense of how big the treasurer's office of state of Kentucky in the mid-19th century would be.
Like square footage or number of employees?
Like how many clerks are there?
He has clerks under him. But I guess he's Honest Dick saying, no, the books are fine. You don't get my system, or I've made another private arrangement, or it's all gonna.
Right.
He had also invested some of this public money in just kind of crazy ventures that didn't work out.
Patent medicine.
Wildcat stocks, mining mostly. I think that was kind of the patent medicine time. Yeah. Mining and real estate speculation.
Yep.
So a lot of his peculations were speculations. And maybe he would have fattened his own coffers on them as well. But maybe he's just on a stick and he's a good old boy who doesn't see much of a difference. What's good for
the goose is good for the gander.
What's good for General Motors is good for the gander,
yeah,
as the old saying goes.
Sure, you can see this throughout politics even unto today. Once you get someone that's effective in office who seems to be—
seemingly effective.
Yeah, seems to be representing the interests of the state or your constituency, boy, it's a lot harder to question their integrity. Because they spread it around. I mean, I think that's the mafia method too, right? Everybody gets a taste, and so the boss stays in power.
Do we think that he's a mafioso on purpose, or is he just such a good guy that all his worst impulses, once given money and power? I mean, I don't really know what to think about Honest Dick. Like, it goes back to this age old question of like, how bad would I be given the opportunity? Like, I think of myself as a good person, and I've certainly never done any serious peculations or defalcations of any kind. But have I just never been mad at somebody to throw the swing? Have I never been mad enough to them near a cliff to push them off? Have I never badly had a family emergency where I needed the money at the same time as I was a custodian for just the right amount that I'm sure I would pay back before people found out?
Well, I feel like money in particular and state money is— they're kind of unreal or fantastical, right? It's not like this guy had a MBA from Thunderbird School of Global Management. He was a guy with a seventh grade education who suddenly was, money in, money out. Things needed to get paid for.
And this is my job to pay for things. The governor needs $5,000. Sure, I'm the treasurer.
And so when something comes across his desk, it's like, we need a turnpike. he's like, here's the money. And then somebody else says, we need to, you know, we could make a bunch of money speculating in silver mining without a really clear basis in financial understanding. You could see just a layman not knowing the distinctions and not understanding what the public trust is.
Even if he gets into the trouble honestly, he is certainly dishonest by the time he's well into it, or once he realizes there's a problem. During his last few months in office, he started paying for everything statewide in checks.
Right, he's dog paddling.
Even transactions that would have been in cash previously. And again, super suspicious, alarm bells should have gone off, but he's honest, Dick. So, he knows, and you know, the fact that it's all these speculative ventures means that he probably thought he could do very well for himself as well. The total bill turns out to be $247,000 in 1888 American dollars.
Which is?
The factor is somewhere in the order of 30 times when you take inflation into account. So that's—
Millions.
That's $6 or $7 million today.
But still— like,
and his $5,000 check for the governor is $150,000 or more, $200,000.
But when you think about the scale of graft in our modern time, $7 million— I mean, I guess people still embezzle $7 million from their father's trucking company, but there are swindlers of our era who have swindled in the billions.
Sure. You need to add many more zeros.
Hard to imagine that $7 million would, absconding with that would be enough to like live the rest of your life. But
no.
I suppose I could live on $7 million.
Do you think if you really cut back? You cut back on your jeans budget and your guitar pick budget and your old postcard budget. How long do you think you could stretch out the $7 million?
I think I could make $7 million last until my dying day.
There are a surprising number of people who think, I saw you win a couple $1 million on TV, Ken. Like, you must have just bought an island and disappeared.
Although, weirdly, a surprising number of people now who think, again, that money is a fantasy. I've had conversations with fully grown adult people who have said when the lottery hits 50 million, they're like, well, I mean, if you won that, it's not like you would be rich.
Oh, it's people who have bounced too far back the other way.
Yeah. They're like, I mean, 50 million.
50 million's not what it was.
I mean, it's not worth like buying a lottery ticket because it's not like 500 million.
The rule of thumb that's often used in financial planning is you can use 4% of your net worth for, you can count on 4% interest every year, and that's, you know, for 100 years, that would keep you safe and never touch the principal, basically.
Right. 4%
in a permanent way. So 4% of 50 million only gives you $2 million a year income. So you can see where you'd have to scrimp.
I mean, it's not, you wouldn't be rich. You'd just be comfortably middle class.
Well, in America, nobody's rich. Everybody's comfortably. Did you see Howard Schultz of Starbucks saying that he doesn't like the word billionaire?
Yeah.
He wishes people would say.
People of means.
People of means. Wealth adjacent.
People of means.
The nerve that he doesn't want people to, you know, I need a euphemism for the fact that I have this insane, sick amount of money.
Yeah, to be called rich is really discriminatory.
What a mean thing to say to poor Howard Schultz. I mean, you know, that whole misunderstanding where he moved to the basketball team, I'll forgive him.
You mean our future president of the United States, Howard Schultz?
Yeah, sorry. If you're listening to this in the future and President Schultz still has his iron grip on power, all hail President Schultz. Venti, venti, venti. So, despite what he had claimed, James Tate never went to Louisville. It was the classic, leave a note to the place you're not going, like when they turned you turn a sign the other way on Hanna-Barbera Laugh Olympics so that they'll follow your trail the wrong way.
Right.
He had actually taken a train to Cincinnati, not even telling his wife and family, I think, or at least having left them behind.
Cincinnati, the capital of Kentucky.
Pretty much.
Let's be honest.
Just across the river. So he's dragging his tobacco sacks full of money. You know, you can imagine the bills spilling out as he hops aboard the train. His family was very ill-treated in his absence, which is why I think maybe they did not know what was going to happen.
Oh, so he just abandoned his wife and kids?
Abandoned his wife and kids. And Kentucky is shook. It's only $7 million. But first of all, I'm sure budgets are smaller back then. That's a pretty big deal. And second of all, it's Honest Dick of all people, the beloved face of the Democratic Party for almost 20 years.
He ruined the nickname Honest for centuries.
He ruined the nickname Dick. Dick used to be good. People used to love Dick.
They, yeah.
The newspapers reported it this way. Such a flash of light and a peal of thunder as was never before seen or heard came out of a clear sky.
Well,
as,
they were
as nothing had done.
There
since
was an awful lot of hyperbole in 19th century newspapers.
Yeah, that's the least hyperbolic sentence in that paper, probably.
Incidentally, the Kentucky Courier is owned by Gannett.
Oh, so it's got a week left. They probably offered 100 people buyouts like since we've been doing this show, like this episode of the show. So he's removed from office in absentia. He's criminally indicted on, I think, 4 different counts of various kinds of defalcation and peculation. It turns out his office was bonded for $300,000, more than he had spent. Two rich Kentucky colonel types whose total net worth was a lot more than that.
Right.
And he had lent out a lot of that money to other people. So his story, you know, the stories that have been told about his generosity were not untrue. People hastened to come forward before they were found out to say, he gave me, you know, $10,000 back in the 1870s or whatever.
Oh, so it was a spider web of indebtedness.
Yeah, and the state begins recouping a lot of this money from people coming forward and saying, oh, well, I still have this chit from Tate. But it's a political catastrophe for the Buckner administration, for old Bolivar, for the Democratic Party. The word for political corruption in Kentucky becomes Tateism.
Oh, Tateism.
More Tateism. That's again.
Still a thing you can accuse someone of in local politics.
I prefer to say he's tatially charged.
You're terrible. You should be keel-hauled for some of your puns.
In 1891, the Kentucky Constitution is even overhauled to institute term limits, just because the idea is he turned bad because he was in for so long.
Oh, this is famous about Kentucky, that they had term limits into the 90s. Like they radical did. Term
Yeah,
limits.
Like you couldn't even be governor twice in a row, right?
One term.
Until 92, I think. And what do you think about that, by the way? If you're a fan of the professional politician, term limits are your enemy, right?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You lose institutional memory. What you gain is a political class of neophytes. And what you lose is anybody that knows.
Yeah, imagine working somewhere where essentially all your managers have to change.
I think every 4 years. The mistaken premise is that new people from outside are honest and not able to be corrupted by special interests, and that's just a fallacy, right?
My assumption is that's an illusion.
Yeah, it
right.
Is.
That
just because
that given
somebody,
the opportunity, almost nobody will say, no, no, tut, tut. I turn my face away from your briefcase of money.
And most people that are noobs in government come from an industry or an area which is affected by government. So somebody from the trucking industry who is tired of regulation decides to run for office because they have this firsthand experience of government.
And it's bad.
And on the other side of the aisle, you have people that are in advocacy and activism who run for government because they're constantly on the activist side, you know, combating government.
I'm not going to both sides of that, though. If we have the choice between a coal lobbyist running the EPA or an environmental activist, that's not a tough call for me.
No, it's not. But you find that the hog trading or the horse trading happens both ways.
Sure. And neither will be good at their job.
Yeah. Neither will be good at the job is exactly right.
Yeah. So the state of Kentucky finds itself out only $40,000 and they decide not even to, the state Supreme Court, I think, rules that the bondmen are not going to be legally liable for Tate's defalcation. I guess they found some fine print that got them out of it. But they do issue they're on the hook for $40,000, they issue a $5,000 bond for his arrest, but he is gone. His family tells everyone that they have received word that he's committed suicide overseas in shame, as one should do.
Sure. If you're going to commit suicide overseas, it should be in shame.
I was
going to
say, if
reasons.
You're going to be ashamed overseas, you should commit suicide.
I think if you're going to...
What's the third option? Commit, which one do we leave out?
If you're going to commit shame...
If you're going to shamefully commit suicide, you should leave the country first, right?
There it is.
But his family later admits they actually received 4 letters from him from 4 different countries. He was in British...
Stuffed full of coin?
Right. All the letters were in tobacco sacks. He was in British Columbia, then he was in San Francisco. Then
famous graft hideouts.
These are the places you would go.
Yeah.
The waterfront of San Francisco, bothering a coolie for a ride across across the Pacific. He's in Japan, he's in China. In 1890, the New York Times reports that he has died in China on very flimsy reporting.
Those would have been exciting times to be in China if you had a tobacco sack full of cash.
Oh, sure. I mean, like, that's like somebody today who decides just to, you know, I have my 1 million because I sold my storage locker business. I'm going to live like a king in Costa Rica.
Right.
People do. My sister-in-law, apparently, Mindy's sister, is combing the world looking for a place where she and her husband can just, like, retire at 50. They're high school teachers, but they think if they find the right part of Malta or
I don't know if Malta's the place, but
you're Malta skeptical.
I'm a little skeptical.
I like how you have a theory about this, and it's not Malta. Let me tell you something about Malta, Ken.
I feel
you
like
have access John Subentry.
There are a lot of, I bet if you went right now, there are a lot of websites devoted to this idea. Like, how do I? On a teacher's retirement.
Where in Slavonia? Slavonia?
Yeah, sure, Slavonia.
A fake country? Where in Slovenia?
Slabovia.
We're in lower Slabovia. Where in Portugal?
Right.
Is the weather nice and the eats cheap?
That's what it is. People also want to live like kings in those places. They don't want to move somewhere cold and live in a shack. They want to live on a beach and have somebody bring them drinks.
They want also socialized European healthcare.
Right.
Even though you think it would shake up the stack too much.
No, I'm sure that in some Polynesian archipelago that the healthcare is free and college is free.
It's all
the drinks are free.
You get stitched up with shark teeth instead of sutures.
It's paid for with money out of a tobacco sack. No one knows where the sack came from. This weathered old sack that says Bank of Kentucky.
It's 7 years later after his purported death. The New York Times reports again that now he's planting coffee in Brazil. I don't know if they issued a correction.
Oh. And he rolled the rock back from his cave.
And stretches.
Oh, I'm not dead yet.
Let me go get my tobacco sack. According to the New York Times story, he has even returned to the States, brazenly coming back for the, joining a delegation for the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago.
Harumph, harumph.
He's going to, you know, he'll flee, but he's not going to miss a World's Fair.
Rhubarb.
He's not insane. His daughter at this time wants him declared dead.
Right.
You're not surprised.
Well, no, because she would then be absolved of the besmirchment of her, She's not like she inherited
anything. You think she's taking some kind of
She wants him declared dead so she can get on with her life.
She also has a life insurance policy.
Oh, there it is.
And in 1898, a Kentucky court obliges and issues a death certificate.
Oh.
And she gets her money. The account in the Encyclopedia of Kentucky reads, "Tate was never again seen by a Kentuckian." Which I guess would be the most reliable kind of witness.
He was very popular in Honduras.
They're silent on whether an Ohioan or a Tennessean might have seen him, but you know who you would trust is a Kentuckian.
Unless they promise you they'll get you a Kentucky colonelship, in which case I would caution restraint.
But this is the classic, or was he? Because in 1897, I guess the same year that the New York Times said he was planting coffee in Brazil, a former senator, N.W. Utley, remembers something unusual that happened to him a decade ago when he was in Japan as a Methodist missionary.
Hmm.
He was crisscrossing the country, seeing the sights. He was at a hot springs in Nikko, and he was at the port of Yokohama, and he was at the beautiful old capital of Kyoto. And in all of them, he kept running across the same person by chance, an elderly gentleman, somewhat careworn and burdened, who said he was an American who had been living late in Canada. So a Canadian hyphen American gentleman. And they hit it off famously and would smoke Manila cigars in their hotel rooms together of an evening. And Utley, a Kentuckian himself, was surprised to find out how knowledgeable this careworn gentleman was about the history and affairs of the great state of Kentucky.
But he was a Kentuckian, but did not know the story of Honest Dick. Surely he would have been versed in this.
Honest Dick, I don't know who that is, but he sounds very handsome.
Tateism.
I don't know if Utley ever asked him about Tate or if he remembered that in hindsight.
Hmm.
But in 1897,
because this wasn't that much longer.
This would have been immediately after his departure from the shores of landlocked Kentucky.
Right.
But in 1897, when the daughter was following her insurance suit, Utley had opportunity to see the letters the family had produced from Tate in Japan. And one apparently had come from the resort at Nikko, and one had come from Yokohama, and one had come from Kyoto. And looking at his notes, oddly is surprisingly the dates match exactly when he had seen his own Kentuckian gentleman in those exact three cities in the exact order.
Huh.
So he may have been the last Kentuckian ever to set eyes on the elusive Honest Dick. And when he wrote his account for the newspapers, he took a very benign view of this pecuniator and defalcator and embezzler.
Look, I'm not going to both sides this, Ken. I think Honest Dick is dishonest.
You are against peculation in all of its forms. Thank you for taking a stand.
Yeah, well, this is my chance to plant a flag.
I want to be, for the record, that embezzling $7 million from the state of Kentucky is not something you should consider under most circumstances.
I find it disagreeable.
Have you ever, in fact, embezzled $7 million from the state of Kentucky?
I am not an embezzler. I used to do the books for some businesses where I worked, and I was very proud that my books were tight and clean.
I mean, there is some satisfaction in fleeing to the Far East with tobacco sacks full of money, but there's another kind of satisfaction that comes in getting a column of figures in a ledger to come out exactly right.
And perfect.
It's hard to say for someone like me, which even is more satisfying.
I have a real fantasy about absconding to the East with sacks full of money, but it's always in a No Country for Old Men context where I steal the wealth from
someone worse.
From baddies, right.
Right. And it's hard to say that the Kentucky taxpayer of the 1880s. I'm sure they were awful on a lot of axes.
They were terrible, but yeah.
But it's not a drug deal gone wrong.
They gave you that money in good faith.
But by the 1890s, Senator Audley, perhaps because, you know, he's a product of the spoils system himself. This is all after the Pendleton Act, by the way. The federal government's been largely reformed, and you can no longer just give money and jobs freely to anyone you like.
Supposedly.
But Utley appears to turn a blind eye to Honest Dick's perhaps alleged pecuniations. Pecuniations? Now I'm just making
that's
up words.
Nice. I like it.
Peculations. Pecuniary peculations. He calls him one of nature's towering noblemen, whose generosity and bounding fellowship had proved the wreck and ruin of his life.
Wow.
He was a victim, you see, of his own good spirit and goodwill toward his fellow men. I was probably the last Kentuckian to grasp his hand and look into his eye. This is a little rich considering he didn't know who he was. A hand and eye which lapsed into stillness and darkness as that of a fugitive.
Dear heaven.
Mixed metaphor. Yet a hand that had never been raised, but at the behest of a generous impulse.
Well, well.
And an eye from which there had never escaped one glance of envy, avarice, or malice.
I wonder if people will eulogize Bernie Madoff this same way.
And a hand that had never been raised but to write a bouncing check.
And that concludes entry 596.EX0288, certificate number 23471 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still survives into your time, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram all were cesspools, swamps.
And yet they outlived the Louisville Courier-Journal.
Sad but true. And we are in there, creatures of the swamp. I am an albino alligator who is maladapted to live in the dark waters.
I am a yawning possum dangling from above by my tail.
You can find our tweets at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project.
At Jack Roderick. Are you going to go get that one? At John Raddar.
I'm sure there's a Jack Roderick.
Reportedly Reeferin Roderick.
I should have done at John Rad Dog Roderick. Maybe that is still there.
Well, you need to get it right now before this time capsule gets unearthed.
You can email us at omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com. Ken will almost certainly answer your email eventually. You can go to our fan group, Omnibus Futurelings, on Facebook, where a very, very active and hilarious merry band trades recipes and sacks full of tobacco sacks full of cash.
Currently stories of overdue library books.
Mm-hmm.
And laughing at me because I called Charles Darwin Charles Dickens. Turns out they're two different people.
Lol.
Who knew?
Hardy har.
I have been under that misapprehension for many, many years.
We get actual mail. We received some mail today. We got a box of a couple of different pounds of coffee, which immediately went to me because Ken doesn't drink coffee.
No one sent me any postum, as I keep requesting.
I scored big there. I got a very nice letter from a young man, 16-year-old in North Carolina, I think. And what else did we get today in the mail? We got some postcards. We get wonderful postcards from people.
Somebody wants us to send their beloved a free anniversary present.
That's right. I got invited to someone's wedding.
You got to save the date.
Yeah, I did.
They don't want me there at all. Unless you have a plus one.
I felt like that was unusual that they would invite me and not you to their wedding, but I want you to come with me if I go. It's right. In Massachusetts.
It's a gay wedding.
No, I don't think so. Oh. I think it was a straight wedding.
They still have those in Massachusetts.
Although, who knows? I don't want to normativize their wedding. They could identify as any number of different things.
They should know that you will not bring a nice gift and that you need me for a plus one.
Yeah, our gift will be our attendance. Or in our case, maybe our gift will be our non-attendance. But anyway, we do get mail and it's lovely.
Basically, John will DJ your wedding is what he's saying.
Yeah. Last week, we got some nudie posters, some nudie calendars like would hang in a garage, like a auto repair garage.
From New Zealand.
From New Zealand.
All the girls were upside down.
What else did we get?
Oh, you know what we got is a brochure from someone who is assembling a full catalog of the world's sidewalk wet cement markings.
This is a wonderful, wonderful idea. She's trying to build a database of photographs and geolocating spots, geolocations.
Coordinates.
Coordinates, thank you. Of all the spots where somebody's carved their name into the cement, or a dog walked across wet cement, or a bird. I think it's a great project.
You and I each have one of those on our property, and we were kind of wondering if it has to be a public thoroughfare to be of interest to
her, in
to
my backyard, all the people that lived here when they poured the concrete around that swimming pool, they all etched their names in it. But I don't think you'd want that on her map because then people would be tromping through your yard.
It sounds like you don't want it on her map.
Do you want somebody coming to see your...
No, I just want someone coming to see yours.
Oh, I see.
And falling into your pool, which is kind of booby-trapped right now, and the tiger eats them.
Maybe we should do that. It should be a great prank where you go geolocate some graffiti on your friend's property.
Or in the middle of a missile testing range.
It'd be like signing up your pal for a magazine subscription to a hilarious magazine.
That happened to us, by the way.
Right.
I don't know if it was because people were mad at me online or...
But you did get a series of racy postcards.
Oh, but in addition to that, like years ago, I was getting just Car and Driver and Modern Maturity and Photography Weekly. Just
people
random.
Just sent stuff to you.
Yeah. I think just because they were mad online. But the joke's on them. I got amazing magazines and never paid.
You love Car and Driver.
It's the worst prank.
Anyway, send us stuff to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our current kleptocracy will survive. We hope and pray that whatever Armageddon we fear may never come. But if the cataclysm comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to return and be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.